Hello, and welcome to the Murder House Radio Show. I'm your host, X. On this show, we will be covering serial killers, killers, mass shooters, disappearances, true crime, and the most deplorable things and people in history. All that good, dark stuff. The Murder House Radio Show will be a radio show slash podcast. I'll be uploading videos every Friday at 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. Make sure you hit the like and subscribe button. Once you hit the subscribe button, hit the bell notification and select all to get all notifications if you are viewing on YouTube. And hit follow if you are listening on a podcasting platform. So sit down, get comfortable, grab some coffee or whatever your preferred beverage is, turn off the lights, and enjoy the show. Hey guys, how's your Friday going? I hope it's going good, and I hope your week was going good. So yeah, hope everything's going good. Let me know how it's going down in the comments. The day I'm recording this is going pretty good. I can't complain so far. But yes, what is it? I think it's the third week of October when this is going up. So halfway through the month almost. So you know, stay strong. But yes, if you wish to ask for some advice to be covered at the end of the podcast slash broadcast, the podcast email will be in the description. Also in the description will be the sources for today's video, so go check those out, because I will not be reading everything directly, and then you can go check and see the information for yourself if you would wish. But without any further ado, let's get into today's video. Today's video will be on Dean Arnold Carroll, and he was born on the 24th of September, 1939. Oh, right, well, Christmas Eve, yeah, word. And then he passed away on August 8th, 1973. So he was an American serial killer who would abduct, rape, torture, and murder teenage boys and young men. And he did this to at least 28 of them. So he has about 28 victims. Interesting. And this was between 1970 and 1973. Holy fuck, that's a short time span or whatever. But yeah, and this happened in Houston, Texas. So, I haven't really, heard of this dude, so we will be learning together on this, episode. But, yeah. So, he was, aided by two teenage accomplices. Oh, shit. David Owen Brooks and, Elmer Wine Hanley. Okay. And then the crimes, which became known as the Houston Mass Murders, came to light after Hainsley fatally shot Coral. Oh, shit. So, okay. So, he was actually murdered by his accomplice. Well, shit. Upon discovery, it was considered the worst example of serial murder in the U.S. history. Holy fuck. So this was before Ted Bundy started killing, I believe. So up until Ted Bundy, word. Coral's victims were usually lured, so they'd usually abduct and lure them with an offer to party or a lift to a succession of addresses in which he raised between 1970 and 1973. So he'd be like, hey, want to come party, or you want to come back to my house or whatnot? And then he would kill him there. But they would then be restrained either by force or decapitation. Holy fuck. Well, that's fucking one extreme. Okay, we're gonna forcefully restrain you, kind of like an arrest, I guess you could say. Or boom, fucking machete to the back of the neck and the head rolls. Holy fuck. But each was killed either by strangulation or a shot with a 22 caliber pistol. Word. All right, word. So that is interesting. Interesting stuff. Carroll and his accomplices buried 17 of the victims in a rented boat shed. Four other victims were buried in the woodland near Lake Sam Rayburn, and one victim was buried on a beach in Jefferson County, and at least six victims were buried on a beach on the Boulevard Peninsula. Okay, so there is that. Brooks and Hainsley confessed to assisting Curl in several abductions and murders, and both were sentenced to life in prison. Okay. Curl was also known as the Candyman and the Pied Piper because he and his family had previously owned and operated a candy factory in Houston Heights. Interesting. And he had been known to give free candy to local children. Well, shit, so I guess there's where the Candyman comes from, maybe. But I've definitely heard of another killer being nicknamed the Candyman. Interesting. So that's a quick rundown on this dude. So let's delve deeper into his life and his early life and all that stuff. So, Correll was born on the 24th of December, like I said, in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he was the eldest child, and, so he's, like, the first child, the eldest child to marry Emma Rosebinson, and, his father was Arnold Edwin Correll. Okay. So, his father was strict with the kids, and whereas his mother was remarkably protective of both her sons. And then, okay. So their marriage was marred by frequent quarreling and couple divorce. So cheating and all that stuff. Turbulence, I guess you could say. And then they got divorced in 1946. And 4 years after the birth of their youngest son, well, younger son, youngest, or whatever, Stanley Wayne Correll, so they, got divorced 4 years after their son was, born, their youngest son, word. So Mary subsequently sold the family home and relocated to a trailer home in Memphis, Tennessee, where Arnold had been drafted into the Air Force, okay. After the divorce, in order that her sons could remain in contact with their father, okay? So, I'm guessing they stayed in contact is what they just kind of said there. Interesting, interesting. But, Dean was, shy kid and a serious child who rarely socialized with other kids, but at the same time displayed concern for the well-being of others. Well, that's fucking ironic, but I guess that's good so far. Sounds pretty normal so far. But when he was 7, he suffered an undiagnosed case of rheumatic fever. What's that? So RF is an inflammatory disease that can involve the heart, joint, skin, and brain. The disease typically develops 2 or 4 weeks after a stereotocola throat infection. Okay, so some big book learning words. So the disease comes around after a certain type of throat infection word. So signs and symptoms may include fever, multiple painful joints, involuntary muscle movements, and a bunch of other shit. But, interesting. So, shy, kind of maybe a sickly child, I guess you could say, but I don't know if I would, go that far. But, he got all that shit, and then, which was not recognized until doctors found he had a heart murmur. Oof. And this was in 1950. But, Because of the diagnosis, Corell was ordered to avoid gym class. I see. Makes sense. Sorry if it sounds like I'm yelling. I just talk loud sometimes, especially when I'm reading. And, you know, it's better that you can hear me instead of not hearing me. So, you know, it'd be like that sometimes. I should put that on a shirt. I say that a lot. It'd be like that sometimes. Also, the way she goes, but that's Trailer Park Boys right there. His parents attempted to get back together, and they remarried in 1950. And then they moved to Podesta, Texas. The marriage was short-lived, and in 1953, the couple once again divorced, so 3 years later. Fuck's sakes. With the mother again retaining custody of her two kids, the two sons, their divorce was granted on amicable grounds, and both boys maintained regular contact with their father. Well, that's good. At least they're staying in contact with the dad. Some women can be gigantic cunt bags and use the kids against the father, and the father could genuinely be a good dude, and the fucking mom's just like, fucking nope, you don't get to see him, talk to him, or even know him, fuck you. And the dad's like, but fucking why, bro? I want to be in my kids' lives. But it's fucking bullshit. But, anyway, so yeah, it seems pretty normal so far. Pretty normal so far. I'm kind of surprised. It just goes to show you that a mass murderer could be growing up and living beside you at any given point in your life, and you'd have no fucking clue. It could even be your kid if you have kids. It's fucked up, man. It's fucked up. But, yeah, so there's a bunch of other stuff. You can go read that. Corell attended Vidor High School, where he was regarded as a well-behaved student who achieved satisfactory grades. Interesting. He was kind of a loner. Okay. He was considered kind of a loner. And although he is known to have occasionally dated girls when he was a teenager in high school, Corell's only major interest was the brass band. Okay. One time at band camp, and he played a trombone. If you've seen American Pie, I think there's like a whole ass story of the chick who went to band camp, who saw someone shove a fucking trombone or some shit up their pussy. I'm pretty sure. Too fucking funny. American Pie is a good movie. I recommend watching it if you haven't. So, he did graduate from school, and this was in 1958, and shortly after, he and his family moved to, the northern outskirts of Houston, so the family's candy business could be closer to the city, where the majority of their products were sold. Makes sense. So they opened a new candy shop or whatnot, which was named Pecan Prince. Interesting. In reference to the brand name of the family products. Fuck, I'm retarded sometimes. yeah. No offense. You gotta say that nowadays. So in 1960, at the request of his mother, Corell moved to Indiana to live with his widowed grandmother, okay? So, during this time, Corell formed a close relationship with a local girl, although he rejected a subsequent marriage proposal she made to him in 1962. Where are all the girls asking dudes to get married nowadays, bro? Like, fuck, that'd be all good. Just a girl comes up, hey, Mr. X, you want to, fucking go on a few dates, maybe get married? Fucking send it. We'll fucking date a little bit, see if you're not a psychotic cunt. And if you're not and you're all good, fucking send it. But Corell lived in Indiana for almost 2 years, but returned to Houston in 62 to help with his family's candy business. Which by this date, had moved to Houston Heights. Word up. The mother got married again, got divorced, and this was, all to and by, blah, 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 Jake West, and this was in 1963. Okay, and they opened up a new candy business, which they named Corel Candy Company. I wonder if it's still a thing. I'm gonna search it up, hold on. I don't think it is, especially since it's associated with a serial killer, so you know. But, yeah, so there is all of that, yeah, Morris, haha. Which she named Corel Candy Company. Her eldest son was appointed vice president of the new family firm, with his younger brother Stanley being appointed secretary treasurer. Oh, fancy, fancy. The same year, one of the teenage male employees of Corel Candy Company complained to Mary West that her son had made sexual advances towards him. Oof. Okay, so there is that. There is that. Teenage. That's fucked up. But, alright. So, pretty normal up until there. There's the first red flag that I'm seeing. But, alright. So, let's keep going. Sexual advances towards him. In response, Corel's mother fired the teenager. Holy fuck. Fuck around and find out. That's fucked up. Jeez. So, it says here something about Army service. Corel was drafted into the United States Army on the 10th of August, 64, and assigned to Fort Polk, Louisiana, for basic training. He was later assigned to Fort Benning, Georgia, to train as a radio repairman before his permanent assignment to Fort Hood, Texas. On military TikTok, I have seen some, fucking wild things about that place. Apparently, it's a shithole to everybody who served there. That's what I have seen. I've never been there myself, but that's what I've seen on the TikToks. But, according to official military records, Corel's period of service in the Army was unblemished, so he didn't get in trouble. And then, word. However, Corel reportedly hated military service. He applied for a hardship discharge on the grounds that he was needed in his family's business. Okay. The Army granted his request and he was given an honorable discharge on June 11th, 1965. After 10 months of service. Well, shit. So there is that. So, allegedly's, Letterkenny's a good show, allegedly's, but, allegedly's, Corel divulged to some of his close acquaintances after his, discharge from the Army that it was during his period of service that he had first realized he was gay, fair enough, and that he had experienced his first homosexual encounter. Other acquaintances noted subtle changes in Corel's mannerisms when in the company of teenage males after he had completed his service and returned to Houston, which led them to believe he may have been homosexual. Well, goddamn. There is all of that. Yeah, it's creepy when a fucking old dude like his age goes for teenagers, bro. That's fucked up. On today's episode of how is fucked up, that is fucked up, or whatever it says. But, yeah. There is, more stuff on the candy company. You can, read that in the sources below. And then it says here, friendship with David Brooks. Was that one of his accomplices? Just give me a second. I will check. I'll be a good fucking podcast radio show host and check. Inspector, fuck you. Oh, it is David Owen Brooks. Word. Alright, bet. Sorry for that little hiatus. Fucking kind of forgot a little bit. So, in 1967, Corel befriended 12-year-old... Okay. In 1967, Correll befriended 12-year-old David Owen Brooks, then Bess Pennell, sixth grade student at one of the many children whom he gave free candy. Okay, so he's in sixth grade and he frequented Dean's candy shop. Okay. Brooks initially became one of Correll's many youthful close companions. That's fucking creepy. Regularly socializing with Correll and various teenage boys who congregated at the rear of the candy factory. Okay. He also joined Correll on regular trips he took to South Texas beaches in company of various youths, and later committed that Correll was the first adult male who did not mock his appearance. Oh, commented word. So, basically he's like, hey, this dude's cool, he gives me candy, we're fucking chill, we're friends, he's nice to me, he's good people. So it seems so far from what this dude has described so far until they go on and murder 28 fucking people. But whenever Brooks told Correll he needed cash, Correll gave him money, and the youth, Bay, began to view Correll as a father figure. See? But that is grooming, if I use that term correctly. That is a textbook case of grooming, I think. But upon Correll's urging, a sexual relationship gradually developed between the two. Okay, that's not good. That's not good at all. Okay. So it was, not normal, but, like, pretty harmless up until he's like, let's start fucking. That's fucked up. That's hella fucked up. But, they developed a sexual relationship beginning in 1969. Correll paid Brooks in cash worth gifts to allow him to perform fellatio on the youth. And fellatio is head. That's fucked up. Okay, then. But, Brooks' parents were divorced. His father lived in Houston and his mother relocated to Beaumont, a city 85 miles east of Houston. In 1970, when he was 15, Brooks dropped out of high school and moved to Beaumont to live with his mother. Whenever he visited his father in Houston, he would also visit Correll. Correll. And by the way, his name's spelled Corll. But who allowed him to stay at his apartment if he wished. Word. Later the same year, Brooks moved back to Houston by his own later admission. Brooks began regarding Correll's apartment as his second home. Okay. Yeah, that definitely makes fucking the Dean Correll dude a fucking pedophile straight the fuck up. But let's get into his murders, the part you have all been waiting for. And as I said, between the years of 1970 and 73, they are known to have murdered 28 people, and all the victims are between the ages of 13 and 20, and the majority of whom were mid-teens. Word. Most victims were abducted from Houston Heights, which was the low-income neighborhood northwest of downtown Houston. Oh, excuse me. With most abductions, he was assisted by one or both of his teenage accomplices. Word. Several victims were friends of one or both of Correll's accomplices. Others were individuals with whom Correll had himself become acquainted prior to their abduction and murder. Okay. So, and two other victims, Billy Belch and Gregory Maley Winkle, were former employees of Correll Candy Company. Well, damn. There is all of that. And then I told you guys how he lured them all and all that stuff. And, yeah. Okay. I told you all about all that. In several instances, Coral forced his victims to either phone or write to their parents with explanations for their absences in an effort to allay the parents' fears of their son's safety. So, okay. He is also known to have retained keepsakes, usually keys, from the victims, okay? So during the years in which he abducted and murdered his victims, Coral often changed addresses. However, until he moved to Podestà in spring of 73, he always lived in or close to Houston Heights. Okay. So there's all that. So, Coral's first known victim, 18-year-old college freshman Jeffrey Konen, K-O-N-E-N, any relation to Samantha Konen in Alaska with the Israel Akis story, I wonder. But Konen vanished while hitchhiking with another student from the University of Texas to his parents' home in Houston. So, he was dropped off alone at the corner of Westmeyer Road, okay, and South Voss Road near uptown area of Houston. Coral likely offered Konen a lift to his home, which Konen evidently accepted. At the time of Konen's disappearance, Coral lived in an apartment in Yorktown Street near the intersection with Westmeyer Road, okay. So, Brooks led the police to, Konen's body, actually, on the 10th of August, 1973. The body was buried in High Island Beach, word. And forensic scientists subsequently deduced that the youth had died by asphyxiation caused by, manual strangulation and a cloth gag that had been placed in his mouth. The body was found buried beneath a large boulder, covered with a layer of lime, wrapped in plastic, naked and bound, hands and foot with nylon cord. Okay, suggesting he had been violated. Oh, damn. Makes sense. So, about the time of Konen's murder, Brooks interrupted Coral in the act of sexually assaulting two teenage boys who, Coral had strapped to a bed. Coral promised Brooks a car in return for his silence. Brooks accepted the offer, and Coral later bought him a green Chevrolet Corvette. Coral later told Brooks that he had killed two youths and offered him $200 for any boys he could lure to his apartment. Well, god damn. So that was the first kill. His second kill was on the 13th of December, 1970. And this was a 14-year-old boy, James Glass from Spring Branch. Oh shit, so there's two. James Glass and Danny Yates. So they lured them away from, a religious rally in Houston Heights to Coral's Yorktown apartment, word. So they lured the two to his apartment from a religious rally, word. Glass was an acquaintance of Brooks who, at Brooks' behest, had previously visited Coral's address. Both youths were tied up to opposite sides of Coral's torture board and subsequently raped, strangled, and buried in a boat shed he had rented on November 17th. An electrical cord was alligator clips attached to each end was buried alongside Yates' body. Well, damn. So, 6 weeks after the double murder of Yates and Glass, on the 30th of January, 71, Brooks and Coral encountered two teenage brothers, Donald and Jerry Waldrop, walking towards their parents' house. The two brothers had been driven to a friend's home by their father with plans to discuss forming a bowling league and had begun walking home after learning their friend was not home. Both boys were enticed into Correll's van and driven to the apartment Correll had rented on Magnum Road, so a different place than the other place or whatnot, where they were raped, tortured, strangled, and subsequently buried in the boat shed. Okay, so, between March and May 1971, Correll abducted and killed three victims, and they all lived in Houston Heights, and all of them were buried towards the rear of the rented boat shed. So in each of the abductions, Brooks is known to have been a participant, so he helped get the victims. One of these victims, 15-year-old Randall Harvey, was last seen by his family on the afternoon of March 9th, cycling towards Oak Forest, where he worked part-time as a gas station attendant. Okay. So, he was shot after, Harvey was driven to Coral's apartment or whatever on Magnum Road, and he was, shot and killed with a single shot to the head, and this was probably with the .22 caliber pistol. So the other two victims, 13-year-old David Hillingist and 16-year-old Gregory Maley Winkle, were abducted and killed together on the afternoon of the 29th of May, 71. So there is that. Well, shit. There is that. So the parents and a friend of one of the victims I mentioned launched a search, and they put up posters and flyers and stuff. But, And then on the 17th of August, 1971, Correll and Brooks ran into a 17-year-old acquaintance of Brooks's named Reuben Watson Haney, walking home from a movie theater in Houston. But, Brooks persuaded Haney to attend a party at an address Correll had moved to on San Felipe Street the previous month. So, Haney agreed and was taken to Correll's home, where he was subsequently strangled and buried in the boat shed. And then on September 71, Correll moved to another apartment in Heights. Brooks later stated he had assisted Correll in the abduction and murder of two youths during the time Correll resided in this address, including one youth who was killed just before Wayne Hainsley came into the picture. In his confession, Brooks stated the youth killed immediately prior to Hainsley's involvement in the murder was abducted from the Heights and kept alive for approximately 4 days before his murder. Oof. The identity of both these victims remain unknown. Well, goddamn. That's fucked up, bro. So, in a whole year or two, they got about 10 victims-ish. About 10. You guys can do the counting. Go back and do the counting if you would like. So, Elmer Wayne Hainley came into the picture on the winter of 1971. He was supposed to be an intended murder victim, but Correll was like, I think he would do good helping me lure boys to be murdered. A good accomplice. So he offered him the same fee of $200 for any boy he could lure to his apartment, informing Hainley that he was involved in a white slavery ring. Holy fuck. So was Elmer Wayne Hainley black, maybe? Just a thought, maybe? I don't know. Because why throw in white slavery ring? I don't fucking know. Anyway, operating from Dallas. Okay. Oh, I did see a thing. Speaking of human trafficking and all that shit, I saw a thing on a YouTube where in Houston, Texas, I think. Well, in Texas for sure, they found 90 people inside a house or whatever. Like, they weren't expecting to find them there, but it was like 90 human trafficking victims. Like, my guess was they were on their way to or from Mexico, or on their way around the world or whatever, because, you know, all this COVID shit, everything is all shut down, so you gotta get around somehow. But, yeah, they found 90 people, like 90 plus people. Some of them had COVID in various stages. It was definitely interesting. It was definitely interesting. So it says here that Hanley stated for several months he ignored Correll's offer. However, in early 72, he decided to accept the offer because he and his family were in dire financial circumstances. Interesting. So Hanley said the first abduction he participated in occurred during the time Correll resided in 925 Schuller Street, the address he moved to in February 72. Brooks later claims that Hanley became involved in the abductions while Correll resided at the address he had occupied immediately prior to Shuttle's Schuller Street. But this is S-C-H-U-L-E-R Street. Okay. So if Hanley's statement is to be believed, the victim was abducted from the Heights in February or early March 72. In the statement Hanley gave to police following his arrest, the youth stated he and Correll picked up a boy at the corner of 11th and Studwood, and lured him to Correll's home on the promise of smoking some ganja with the pair. Okay. So when they were at Correll's house, they used a ruse he and Correll had prepared. Hanley cuffed his own hands behind his back, freed himself with a key hidden in his back pocket, and duped the youth into donning the handcuffs, like putting them on, before observing Correll bind and gag him. Okay. So, he's like, showed him like a magic trick or whatever. Hey, look at me get out these cuffs. I guess, like, hey, you try this. So he did it, put him on, and then they bind and gagged him or whatever. Word. Hanley then left the youth alone with Correll, believing he was to be sold into a sexual slavery ring. The identity of this first victim Hanley assisted in the abduction remains unknown. That's not any fucking better, holy shit. Yeah, I helped abduct him. Oh, I only thought he's going into a fucking sex slave ring, not to be murdered. That's fucked up, bro. Holy shit. Fuck's sakes. So now the three are working together. So 1 month later, on the 24th of March, 72, Hanley, Brooke, and Correll encountered an 18-year-old acquaintance of Hanley's, named Frank Aguirre, leaving a restaurant on Yale Street, where the youth worked. Okay. So, they called, the youth over to Correll's van and invited the youth to drink beer and smoke weed with them at Correll's apartment. Okay. So the youth agreed and they, followed the trio home and so they followed him home after he agreed. Fuck around. I can't fucking read sometimes, bros. But, there is, that. So they followed him home under the guise to smoke marijuana. They, started smoking weed or whatever. And, before picking up a pair of handcuffs Correll had left on his table, in response, Correll pounced on the youth, pushing him onto the table and cuffing his hands behind his back. Okay, so Hanley later claimed or whatever said that he had not known what Carl's true intentions towards Aguirre were when he had persuaded his friend to accompany him and Carl home. Okay, so there's that. He's like, yeah, he's my friend. I didn't know he's gonna fucking kill him. Worst element of fucking sex slavery. Fuck around. But, yeah. In a 2010 interview, he claimed to have attempted to persuade Corell not to assault and kill Aguirre once Corell and Brooks had bound and gagged the youth. However, Corell refused, informing Hanley that he had raped, tortured, and killed the previous victim he had assisted in abducting, and that he intended to do the same with Aguirre. And Hanley subsequently assisted Corell and Brooks in Aguirre's burial at High Island Beach. Well, goddamn. So, there was a lot more murders and all that. You guys can read up on them all. They're along the same MO as the ones I've described up till this point. But the last murder that Corell committed was on August 3rd, 73, and Corell killed his last victim, 13-year-old James Santon Drymela was abducted by Brooks and Corell while riding his bike in Pasadena, and driven to Lamar Drive upon the presence of collecting empty glass bottles to resell. Okay, so they're like, hey, well, go pick up some glass bottles and you can resell them. Come with me, get in the car or whatever and all that stuff. So there is all that. And yes, in between what I said last about the last killing and now, they moved to another address, which was what I just said, it is, Lamar Drive, so that's where they moved to, Lamar Drive. But, at, Corell's home, Drymela was tied to, Corell's torture board, raped, tortured, and strangled with a cord before being buried in the boat shed. Brooks later described Drymela as a small blonde boy, from whom he had bought pizza and is whose company he spent 45 minutes before the youth was attacked. Oof. So that was the last murder that Corell committed. And then, his death. Okay. So, on the night of the 7th of August, 1973, Hanley, when he was 17, invited 19-year-old Timothy Cordell Carrolly to attend a party at a Corell's residence, his house or whatnot. And Carrolly, a casual acquaintance of Corell's who was intended to be his next victim, accepted the offer. I almost said author. But Brooks was not present at the time. The two youths arrived at Corell's house where they sniffed paint fumes and drank alcohol until midnight before leaving the house to purchase a sandwich. Hanley and Carrolly, that's a wild last name, especially for a dude. That would suck. But they drove back to Houston Heights, and Carrolly parked his vehicle close to Hanley's home. Hanley exited the vehicle and hearing commotion across the street, emanating from the home of his 15-year-old friend, Rohad Lewis Williams, walked towards her home. Williams had been beaten by her drunken father. Okay. And that evening, and accepted Hanley's invitation to join him after Carrolly and Corell's home. Okay, so they picked up a girl who had been beaten by her father that night or whatever, and they're like, "Hey, you want to come to this party we are going to?" And she was like, "Sure." Williams climbed into the back seat of Carrolly's Volkswagen, and the trio drove towards Corell's house. Amen, word. At about 3 a.m. on the morning of the 8th of August, 1973, Hanley and Carolee, accompanied by Williams, returned to Correll's house. Correll was furious that Hanley brought a girl to his house, telling him in private that he had ruined everything. Hanley explained that Williams had argued with her father that evening and did not wish to return home. Correll appeared to calm down and offer the trio beer and weed. The three teenagers began drinking and smoking weed, with Hanley and Carolee also sniffing paint fumes as Correll watched them intently. And then after approximately 2 hours, Hanley, Carolee, and Williams passed out, like went to sleep. So that's the circumstances leading up to the actual shooting. So Hanley woke up to find himself laying on his stomach and Correll snapping handcuffs to his wrists. His mouth had been taped shut and his ankles had been bound together. Carolee and Williams lay beside Hanley, securely bound with nylon ropes, gagged with adhesive tape, and laying face down on the floor. Carolee had been stripped naked. Oof. Noting Hanley had awoken, Correll removed the gag from his mouth. Hanley protested in vain against Correll's actions. I don't even know if I'm fucking saying the killer's name right. I fucking hope I am. I'm going with Dean. Dean reiterated that he was angry with Hanley for bringing the girl to his place, and that he was going to kill all three of them after he had assaulted and tortured Carolee, initially stating, "Man, you blew it, bringing that girl." Oof. Before shouting, "I'm going to kill you all, but first I'm going to have my fun," he then repeatedly kicked Williams in the chest, so the girl, before lifting Hanley to his feet, dragging him to his kitchen, and placing a .22 caliber pistol against his stomach, threatening to shoot him. Hanley calmed Correll, promising to participate in the torture and murder of both Williams and Carolee if Correll released him. After approximately 30 minutes of talking, Dean, the killer, agreed and untied Hanley, then carried Carolee and Williams into the bedroom and then tied them opposite sides of the torture board. Carolee on his stomach, Williams on her back. Okay. Dean then handed Hanley a hunting knife and ordered him to cut away Williams' clothes, insisting that while he would rape and kill Carolee, Hanley would do likewise to the girl, Williams. Hanley began cutting away the girl's clothes, and Dean undressed and began assaulting and torturing Carolee. Both Carolee and Williams had awakened by this point, and Carolee began writhing and shouting as Williams, whose gag Hanley had removed, lifted her head and asked Hanley, "Is this for real?" To which Hanley answered, "Yes." Williams then asked Hanley, "Are you going to do anything about it?" Okay, goddamn. Hanley asked Dean whether he might take Williams into another room. Dean ignored him, and Hanley then grabbed Correll's pistol, shouting, "You've gone far enough, Dean." As Dean clamored off Carolee, Hanley elaborated, "I can't go on any longer. I can't have you kill my friends." Dean approached Hanley, saying, "Kill me, Wayne." Hanley stepped back a few paces as Dean continued to advance upon him, shouting, "You won't do it." Hanley then fired at Dean, hitting him in the forehead. The bullet failed to fully penetrate, so it failed to penetrate Dean's skull. And he continued to lurch forward. Hanley, whereupon the youth fired another two rounds, hitting Dean in the left shoulder. Okay, Dean then ran out of the room, hitting the wall of the hallway, okay? And Hanley fired three additional bursts into the lower back and shoulder as Dean slid down the wall in the hallway outside the room where the two other teenagers were bound. Dean died where he fell, his naked body laying face towards the wall. Good fucking piece of shit. They're all pieces of shit, really, fuck. Hanley would later recall that having shot Dean, the sole thought in his mind in the moment immediately thereafter was that Dean would have been proud of the way he had behaved during the confrontation, adding that he had been training him to react quickly and forcefully, and that this was exactly what he had done. Well, shit. After he had shot Dean, Hanley released Curly and Williams from the torture bed, and all three teenagers dressed and discussed what actions they should take. Hanley suggested to Curly and Williams that they should simply leave, to which Curly replied, "No, we should call the police." Hanley agreed and looked up the number for the Poseidon, PASADENA, Police Department, PPD, in Dean's telephone directory, so the phone book. Word. So there is all that. That's a fucking wild-ass story right there. Jesus Christ. Something right out of a movie, if you think about it, but, it actually happened, and let alone to fucking teenagers. It's fucking wild. Fucking this Dean Corll is a fucking monster, bro. So, at 8:24 a.m. on the 8th of August, 1973, Hanley called the police. His call was answered by an operator, of course. And in his call, Hanley blurted to the operator, "Y'all better come here right now. I just killed a man." Hanley gave the address to the operator as 2020 Lamar Drive, Pasadena. Well, the fucking place they were. Fuck sakes and fuck you with your pronunciations. But, Pasadena. Hey, bud. But, yes, so he gave them the address and whatnot as Curly, Williams, and Hanley waited for, they waited on Dean's porch for the police to come. Hanley mentioned to Curly that he had done that killed... What? So, he told Hanley, Hanley mentioned to, Curly that he had done that killed by shooting four or five times. So he said he'd killed four or five more people other than Dean. Okay. And then minutes later, the police arrived at the address, and the three teenagers were sitting on the porch outside the house. And the officer noted the .22 caliber pistol on the driveway near the trio. Hanley told officer that he was the individual who had made the call and indicated that Dean's body was inside the house. After confiscating the pistol and placing Hanley, Williams, and Harley inside the police car, the officer entered the bungalow and discovered Dean's body inside the hallway. Okay. The officer returned to the car and read Hanley his Miranda rights. In response, Hanley shouted, "I don't care who knows about it. I've got it off my chest, okay?" Curly later told detectives that before the police officer had arrived at the address, Hanley had informed him, "If you wasn't my friend, I could have gotten $200 for you." Holy fuck. That's fucked up, bro. God damn. So when they were interrogating Hanley for the murder of Dean, he recounted the events I just told y'all, and then Hurley and Williams corroborated Hanley's account, and the detective questioning Hanley believed he had indeed acted in self-defense. And when questioned regarding his claim that Dean had threatened him that morning, he had shouted that he had killed several boys. Hanley explained that for almost 3 years, he and Brooks had helped procure teenage boys, some of whom had been their own friends, for Dean, who had raped and murdered them. Hanley then gave a verbal statement stating he initially had believed the boys had been abducted, that the abducted were sold into a Dallas-based organization for homosexual acts, sodomy, maybe later killing. But soon learning, Dean was himself killing the victims produced or procured, Hanley admitted he had assisted Dean in several abductions and murders, and that he had actively participated in torturing and mutilating of 6 or 8 victims prior to their murders. Most victims had been buried in the Southwest Houston boat shed, with others buried in Lake Sam Rayburn in a High Island beach. Dean had paid up to $200 for each victim he or Brooks were able to lure to his apartment. So that's all his confession and stuff. Yeah, sorry if it seems a little choppy at times. My brain just short-circulates sometimes. If you get that reference, you're all good, Trailer Park Boy tings. But, police initially were skeptical of Hanley's claims, assuming the sole homicide of the case was that of Dean, which they had ascribed to being the result of a drug-fueled fisticuffs that had turned deadly. Okay. Hanley was quite insistent, however, and upon his recalling the name of 3 boys, Cobble, Hilligest and Jones, whom he stated he and Brooks had procured for Dean, the police accepted that there was something to his claims, as all 3 teenagers were listed as missing at Houston Police Department headquarters. So there is all that. They're like, so he mentioned all these killings and all this stuff, and the police were like, meh, this probably could be bullshit. He named the names, and they're like, oh, wait, these kids are actually fucking missing. But, yes. So there is all that. Moreover, the floor of the room where the 3 teenagers had been tied was covered in thick plastic sheeting. Police also found a plywood torture board measuring 8 by 3 feet with handcuffs attached to a nylon rope at 2 corners, and nylon rope on the other 2. Also found at Dean's address were a large hunting knife, rolls of clear plastic of the same type used to cover the floor, a portable radio rigged to a pair of dry cells to give increased volume, so like a speaker, an electric motor with loose wires attached, 8 pairs of handcuffs, and a number of dildos, thin glass tubes, and lengths of rope. Well, holy shite. So this kind of sounds like a gay BTK almost, but yeah, just a little bit. But Dean's Ford Escalade van parked in the driveway conveyed a similar impression. The rear windows of the van were sealed by opaque blue curtains, okay. In the rear of the vehicle, police found a coil of rope, a swatch of binge rug covered in soil stains, and a wooden crate with air holes drilled in the sides. The pegboard walls inside the rear of the van were rigged with several rings and hooks. Another wooden crate with air holes drilled in the sides was found in Dean's backyard. Inside this crate were several strands of human hair. Oof. That is fucking wild. Holy shite. Can't believe I've never heard of this fucking dude. Like, fuck. So Hanley agreed to accompany the police to Dean's boat shed in southwest Houston, where he claimed the bodies of most of the victims could be found. Inside the boat shed, police found a stolen, half-stripped car, a child's bike, a large iron drum, water containers, two stacks of lime, and a large plastic bag full of teenage boys' clothes. Okay. Two prison trustees began digging. Two prison trustees began digging through the soft soil shell crust of earth of the boat shed and soon uncovered the body of a young blonde-haired teen boy lying on his side, encased in a clear plastic and buried beneath a layer of lime. So they found the first body and they had the prison trustees do it. So they were using slave labor. But, yeah, that's fucking lazy of the cops. Why don't you just get other cops to do it? Why get prisoners to fucking do it? Holy shit. But, anyhow, police continued excavating through the earth of the shed, unearthing the remains of more victims in varying states of decay. Most of the bodies found were wrapped in thick, clear plastic sheeting. Some victims had been shot, others strangled, the ligature still wrapped tightly around their necks. Well, goddamn. All victims found had been sodomized, and most victims found bore evidence of sexual torture. Pubic hairs had been plucked out, genitals had been chewed, objects had been inserted into their butts, and glass rods had been inserted into their dick holes and smashed. I just cringe. Fuck me about that. Oh, fuck around. Cloth rags had also been inserted into the victims' mouths, and adhesive tape wound around their faces to muffle their screams. The tongue of the first victim uncovered protruded over 1 inch beyond the tooth margin, whatever that means. The mouth of the third victim unearthed on the 8th of August was so agape that all the upper and lower teeth were visible, leading investigators to theorize the boy had died with a scream on his lips. So he has died screaming, basically. After the recovery of the 8th body from the boat shed was completed, at 11:55 p.m., the investigation was discontinued until the next day. Oh, shit. So they just found a bunch of fucking bodies. And on August 9th, Hanley gave a full written statement to the police confessing to all the fuckery him and Brooks did and all that shit and all that other good stuff. Well, not good stuff, but you can read all this in the motherfucking description, you motherfucker. But, yeah, all that stuff. And then, by May 11th, 1974, the 21st of May, 1974, blah, 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 blah. Dean's victims had been identified with all but four of the youths having either lived in or had connections with Houston Heights. And two more teenagers were identified in 1983 and 1985. And one of whom, Richard Kepner, lived in Houston Heights. The other youth, Willard Branch, lived in Oak Forest District of Houston. Okay. And then on the 13th of August, a jury, they all got in fucking, life sentences and shite. They got life sentences. You can check out the trials and convictions in the description. In the fucking description. But, yeah, there's all that stuff. All the murders, all that stuff. But, yeah, check it out in the description. Yeah! The fucking, repair dude came, and I had to answer the door, and I sat outside with my dog drinking a tall boy. And I'm kind of buzzed right now, as you can tell. I'm stumbling my words more than usual. I didn't even finish it. It's, oh, there's a decent little bit left, fucking A. But, yeah. What potential association with the National Sex Ring? During a routine investigation in March 1975, the Houston Police Department discovered a H of pornographic pictures and films depicting boys as young as 8, most of whom were found who were from the Heights. Of 16 individuals depicted within the films and photos, 11 of the youths appeared to be among Dean's known victims who had been identified by this date. The discovery raised disturbing possibilities that the statements Dean had given to the boys, to both Hanley and Brooks, prior to his murder, he was associated in an organization with a child sex ring, blah, 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 a sex ring, may indeed have been a little bit truthful. Okay, the discovery of the material in Houston in 1975 subsequently led to the arrest of 5 individuals in Santa Clara, California. No direct link in these arrests to Dean was proven, as the Houston Police Department declined to pursue any possible link to the killing, stating they felt Dean's victims' families had suffered enough. Well, you gotta know the full fucking extent, motherfucker. But yeah, put them all in the fucking ground. That's how I fucking see it. All in the fucking ground. Let's go. But, yeah. 2 days after investigators had uncovered the final bodies initially linked to the Houston mass murders, investigators in Dallas uncovered a nationwide homosexual sex ring or whatever. This police raid seized a card filing system containing up to 10,000 names of individuals across America ascribed to this network, and the personal details of numerous teenage boys exploited by this ring. Oh, that's fucked up. God damn. On today's episode of How Fucked Up Is Fucked Up, this is fucked up. Holy fuck, let me get another sip of the tall boy. Holy fuck, how fucked up. Some good shit. The beer, not this other shit. Fuck this shit. But, there is still no conclusive evidence to suggest that Dean had ever solicited any of his victims in this manner. Not only because Houston Police Department chose not to pursue this potential possibility, but also because neither Brooks nor Hanley ever mentioned having met an individual from the organization Dean had claimed he was involved with. In addition, neither mentioned having seen any of the victims either filmed, photographed, or released from the devices Dean's blah, 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 alright, word. So I was just gonna say, he could have been recording it, like, maybe secret cameras, but I doubt it. They probably want that high-quality fucking porn of not-good type of porn. Like, fuck around. But, yeah, that's fucked up. Holy shit. That is fucking wild. This whole case is fucking wild, bro. Fucking wild. God damn, boyish. Fuck. Some wild shit, but, you know, read it all in the description below and stuff. I think this is one of the most wild ones I've covered so far. Fucking wild as shit. Straight out of a movie or some shit, bro. But there are 2 movies loosely based on all this stuff. 5 biographies. 4 television shows and 1 podcast, 2 including this one. Your favorite podcast with your boy Mr. X. Yeah. But yeah, it's fucking wild. Some wild fucking shit, my dudes. But yeah, there's no advice for this podcast, sadly. In the future for sure. But yeah, I should probably maybe stop recording all these shits, like pre-recording, so I can actually get some advice and stuff. But you know, it'll be all good. But yeah, that's about it. That about wraps it up. So that is Dean Coral. I believe that's how you fucking say it. Thank you for listening to this episode on the Murder House Radio Show. I hope you have a good rest of your Friday, or whenever you are listening to this. Check out the social medias and the sources in the description below. Make sure you hit the like and subscribe button. Once you hit the subscribe button, hit the bell notification and select all to get all notifications if you are listening on YouTube. If you are listening on a podcasting platform, hit follow. Leave your suggestions for future episodes in the comments. See you next episode. This is your host X, signing off.